You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO, at 102.7 FM.
The BC Federation of Labour recently released a report, Still Waiting for Justice, Update 2009, Provincial Policies and Gender Inequality in British Columbia. The report details how government policy has affected women since the BC Liberals took power 8 years ago. The report also argues that the current financial crisis presents an opportunity to reshape public policy in ways that would promote gender equality and social justice, an opportunity that is being squandered. On the line with me now is Gillian Crease. She is Professor of Sociology and Director of the Center for Women's and Gender Studies at UBC, and she is co-author of the report. Hello, Gillian. Welcome to Red Eye.
Well, thank you for having me.
If you had to briefly state what the primary hope you had in writing this report, what would that be?
We hope that people will begin to think again about how different public policies can affect men and women differently and can affect other groups differently, too, those who are more privileged versus those who are less privileged, because this isn't just about gender. In British Columbia, it's very much about issues of racialization, too. Aboriginal British Columbians, for example, who've been hurt much more than others by these kinds of policies, and recent immigrants who also get hurt more by these policies.
Your report outlines how, over the last several years, the wage gap between men and women in British Columbia has widened. How big is that gap currently?
Well, the gap is about 70 cents. Women are still making about 70 cents for every dollar that men make, if we look only at full-time, full-year employment. When we consider the fact that women are much more likely to be part-time, more likely to be casual, then that gap grows, and it grows to about 66 cents for every dollar. That statistic has changed very little over the past 20 years. It goes up a little, it goes down a little, but it's changed very, very little overall. But what's really happened is not just that wage gap, but that those wealthier are becoming more concentrated in wealth, and those who are poorer are becoming poorer. So it's not just the percentage, it's also the degree of difference between the wealthy and the poor that's increased.
And why is that?
Largely because of public policies. BC has, as we know, an $8 an hour minimum wage, and about three-quarters of minimum wage workers are women. And recent immigrants as well, I should add. So it means that as wages have gone way up at the top, they've been suppressed at the bottom levels. And in real terms, in fact, they've dropped at the bottom levels. And that means that the depth of poverty and the level of poverty has increased.
And has privatization of public services had some disproportionate effect on women vis-a-vis men?
Yeah, it has a huge impact because the public sector is a major employer for women. Well over 70% of public sector employees are female. So every time we adopt a public policy that suggests that we need to cut back on public services and we need to lay off public sector workers, we're talking about laying off women. The layoffs that the current Liberal government did between 2002 and 2004 in the public sector, 20,000 jobs, 75% of those were women's jobs. What's really important about this in terms of gaps in wealth and poverty is that public sector jobs are amongst the best jobs for women because women get paid more in the public sector than they do in the private. They're more likely to be unionized, they're more likely to be professional jobs, and the pay gap between men and women is much lower in the public sector than it is in the private sector.
So for men, given their unionization is greater in the private sector, the difference between private and public is not as significant. But for women, that's really a crucial difference.
That's absolutely correct. Women are also the primary recipients of many public services. So women get hit doubly when we cut back in the public sector. They both get hit because they're more likely to be laid off, but also because they're less likely to get the services that they need, and those are disproportionately services that women use.
And I would assume with all the changes in the EI, that also must have an inequality increasing factor in the changes in EI.
Yeah, it has a huge impact. I mean, the changes you're talking about happened in 1997, and it's been well documented that whereas about two-thirds of working Canadians, once they were laid off, could qualify for EI prior to those changes, now it's about 40%. But because it's had a disproportionate impact on part-time and casual workers who can't qualify, only about a third of women can qualify for EI.
Hmm.
So it really does have a disproportionate impact. More men are able to qualify when they're unemployed than women are. But for both men and women now, it's a problem. We're moving into much higher levels of unemployment without the safety net we had in place the last time we had high levels of unemployment.
The Liberals provincially have also made some changes to employment standards. Can you explain the effect that has had on gender inequalities?
Yeah, employment standards set a basic floor for standards that all workers should have in the province. One of the things that the government did is they took unionized workers out of that. So now anybody who's in a union is no longer covered even by minimal standards, which means that unionized workplaces now a lot of energy has to go into just negotiating those minimums before they can get better standards. But for anyone not in a union, these are the basic rights that people have. And decreasing those rights, therefore, means that people have far fewer protections. So how did they decrease them? One of the key ways is simply to stop enforcing them. Now, the only enforcement is self-directed. It's a grievance complaint-based process. And in order to launch a complaint, a worker who feels their rights are being neglected has to use a self-help kit and confront their employer directly with that self-help kit, a kit that I should add is only available in English. So it's really decreased the rights of workers who are in non-unionized workplaces, and particularly workers who are in lower-wage jobs who are much more likely to not know what those rights are. And, of course, that's all gendered because women are more likely to be in the lower-wage jobs.
Are there other changes that would also disproportionately affect women?
In terms of labor standards?
Yes.
There were others, including the move from a two-hour minimum shift, a four-hour minimum shift to a two-hour minimum shift. These things are all things that make it more difficult for anyone who has childcare, for example, and therefore it's harder to schedule. There were also changes that allow workers to work longer than an eight-hour shift. It's supposed to be negotiable, but you can work 6 hours one day, 10 or 11 the next day, theoretically as long as you agree. But the problem for women in particular is that it makes work less dependable and therefore less easy to coordinate around things like childcare. It also simply makes it more expensive if you're only coming in for 2 hours. The very cost of childcare, transportation, etc., especially for minimum wage workers, can make it just not worth the effort at all.
You've mentioned childcare, and of course women do an enormous amount of unpaid labor, and so how is all that reality really, and there have been cuts, of course, and inadequacies in the childcare. How would you detail some of those consequences for the inequities that that face women in employment?
I think the failure to invest in adequate, affordable, accessible childcare is, in my mind, possibly the biggest contributor to the continuing income gap between men and women, because that income gap exists not only at the lower wages but also at higher wage jobs. Because women still are primarily responsible for childcare and for other kinds of family care as well, it means that without access to adequate child care. Women are much more limited in the kinds of jobs they can take. They need, geographically, they need to think about, you know, whether they're closer to home. They're less likely to be able to travel for work, less likely to be able to take promotions, to go to night school and take additional training, all of those kinds of things, if they're primarily responsible for the home as well. And this is true not only in jobs that are not paying particularly well, but even in higher-end professional jobs. And one of the reasons why there continues to be a real gap, even though women have moved into professional jobs in a very big way, you know, for example, law and medicine, and yet there's still huge wage gaps between women and men in law and medicine. And the unequal division of childcare and other household work is one of those key contributors to that. Women simply cannot put in a 60-hour week and still do all those other things. Men couldn't either if they didn't have somebody at home doing the rest of the work that they're not doing at home.
Would the implication of this be that in Quebec, where there is much more accessible child care and accessible in the sense of being inexpensive and well-regulated and provided, mean that you would expect less gap in the earning situation of women and men? Or is that not that consequential a factor by itself without other changes?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and I think over time you might expect some, but only if you're looking within occupations. So the concentration of women in lower wage jobs isn't going to go away because of that. But within occupations, so I think it'll advantage most women who are at the higher ends, if you know what I mean. I mean, the lawyers, the doctors, etc. But how much will it, or how long will it take to actually have an impact on freeing up women so that they're not concentrated on those low-wage jobs? And that could take quite a long time still.
Your report also speaks about our current economic crisis.
Yes.
and calls for us to rethink economic and social policies in ways that can promote gender equality. When we look at, from that perspective and that standard, at the stimulus, quote-unquote, budgets, which are being announced by governments provincially here and, of course, as a common phenomenon at national levels around the world, is it true that there has been any consideration of gender equality as one of the goals that should guide a stimulus budget?
I've certainly not heard any consideration of gendered impacts, and when we look at the policies taking place in Canada, both at the federal level and provincially, it looks like there has been none in terms of assessing the gender differences. If you look at where money is going, it's going into certain kinds of infrastructure projects, and those are ones that we can link to things like construction, transportation, jobs for engineers, for example. Those are all predominantly male jobs. This would be a perfect opportunity to put a national child care program into place, for example. Those would be predominantly women's jobs. It would be a perfect opportunity to upgrade education and health care. Those are predominantly women's jobs. None of that is happening. We're talking about roads and bridges. We're talking about building concrete buildings. I'm not suggesting there's anything wrong with those things, and probably we need to put more money in there too, because we haven't for a long time paid a lot of attention to the physical infrastructure. But we need to understand that these are very gendered jobs, and if we continue to simply put money into those physical infrastructure that are connected to men's jobs, there's going to be a very unequal outcome in terms of who gets access to this kind of fiscal stimulus.
Is that inequity symbolized by the vocabulary shovel ready?
Oh, it certainly is. Yes, when we think about we're literally talking about shovels. Not that men are using shovels in these jobs anymore. They're using, you know, very heavy duty equipment. But yes, it's right there in the language, and yet it's not being thought through in terms of the gendered implications for economic restructuring that we're going through.
And, of course, the social public sector is being slashed simultaneously, as I think you've alluded to, as these projects to stimulate the economy are being generated.
That's right. In British Columbia, it goes along with $3 billion in cuts. And we know what the likely consequences of that will be, and that will be more jobs lost in the public sector, and those will be predominantly women's jobs, and more services lost. That will be services that particularly women, and particularly poorer women, whether they're elderly, whether they're single mothers, that they need to access, and but they won't have access to.
How do we raise consciousness of the gender inequities in public policy?
I think we have to begin by rethinking this kind of neoliberal ideology that's been so dominant in the last 20 years, which has assumed that we're all ungendered individuals, and that we can think about the economy as a series of individuals who are unconnected to each other, instead of thinking about how we're all embodied as men, as women, how we have families. We are not unconnected in this way, and begin to think about social policy and not just this these sets of economic assumptions linked to the market as if they're not linked to other elements in society. So I really think we've got to put economic policy back into social policy. And if we do that, then we can rethink these issues also around equity and social justice. And until we begin to do that, I don't think we're going to be looking at gender. In fact, we make the argument in the report, following from some other people who have looked at this as well, particularly Janine Brody and Isabella Baker, who have looked at how gender equity has disappeared from federal public policy. We've made the argument that there's been an intentional erosion of attention to things like gender because it doesn't fit with a neoliberal way of looking at the world.
Well, thank you very much for explaining the report and responding to the crisis we're facing. Thanks.
Well, thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
I've been speaking with Gillian Kreese. She's director of the Center for Women's and Gender Studies at UBC. She's co-author of the report, Still Waiting for Justice, Update 2009, Provincial Policies and Gender Inequality in British Columbia. And if you'd like to read that report, you can download a copy of it at the website of the BC Federation of Labour. And that website is very simply bcfed.org.